This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. The U.S. government is launching what it calls a conflict observatory to document war crimes and other atrocities in Ukraine perpetuated by Russian forces. We get details from VOA's chief national correspondent Steve Herman in Washington.
State Department spokesman Ned Price says documentation compiled by the conflict observatory will provide evidence for war crimes trials.
It will shine a light on atrocities and is intended to contribute to eventual prosecutions in Ukraine's domestic courts, courts in third-party countries, U.S. courts, and other relevant tribunals.
The State Department is collaborating with outside entities for the project, including a geographic information systems company, Yale University's Humanitarian Research Lab, and the Smithsonian Cultural Rescue Initiative. The U.S. government is also contributing commercial satellite imagery. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
The fall of Mariupol appears at hand as Ukraine is moving to abandon a sprawling steel plant where its soldiers had held out under relentless bombardment for months, which would make it the biggest city to fall into Russian hands. Much of it, though, has been reduced to rubble. Ukraine estimates some 20,000 civilians have been killed in the Russian assault on Mariupol, a city on the Azov Sea that stands between the Russian mainland and the Crimean Peninsula, which Russia seized from Ukraine in 2014. Hundreds of Ukrainian fighters have left the steel plant and turned themselves over to Russian hands. Ukraine officials say efforts continue to get the remaining troops in the plant out to safety. The U.S. State Department said Tuesday that it is still pushing to have a regular contact with WNBA star Brittany Griner, who has been detained in Russia for nearly 3 months. A consular official was able to meet with her last week. This is VOA News. The roommate of the man charged with the mass shooting at a Southern California church says that he was quiet and kind during the 3 months they lived together. Police say that 68-year-old David Wenwei Chow was motivated by hatred of Taiwan when he opened fire Sunday on a congregation of mainly elderly Taiwanese. Jordan Davis lived with Chow in Las Vegas. He told the Associated Press Tuesday that Chow only spoke about Taiwan once less than 2 weeks ago. Chow was born and raised in Taiwan. Davis says that Chow believed the Taiwanese government was corrupt. Chow was charged with murder and attempted murder in the shooting that killed one and wounded five. The United States said that it strongly advocates for Taiwan to regain its observer status in the World Health Assembly. The decision-making body of the World Health Organization, or WHO. We get more from VOA's Marissa Melton.
Taiwan has not been invited to attend the WHO's annual meeting May 22nd through 28th in Geneva. On Tuesday, State Department spokesperson Ned Price told reporters that while the world is battling the COVID-19 pandemic and other public health threats, Taiwan's isolation from the WHO is unwarranted. U.S. officials and lawmakers have praised Taiwan's public health expertise and its resilience in the face of COVID-19. The State Department's renewed support for Taiwan comes days after U.S. President Joe Biden signed into law a bill that directs the Secretary of State to develop a strategy to regain observer status for Taiwan and the World Health Organization. Marissa Melton, VOA News.
North Korea on Wednesday reported 232,880 new cases of fever and another six deaths as leader Kim Jong-un accused officials of immaturity and slackness in handling the escalating COVID-19 outbreak. The country's antivirus headquarters said 62 people have died and more than 1.7 million fell ill amid a rapid spread of fever since late April. It said more than a million people recovered, but at least 691,170 remained in quarantine. Outside experts say most of the illnesses would be COVID-19, although North Korea has been able to confirm only a small number of COVID-19 cases since acknowledging an Omicron outbreak last week, likely because of insufficient testing capabilities. Recapping our top story, the U.S. government is now launching what it calls a conflict observatory to document war crimes and other atrocities in Ukraine perpetuated by Russian forces. More at VOAnews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Today is Wednesday, May 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, the U.S. launches a conflict observatory to document alleged war crimes in Ukraine by Russian forces.
State Department spokesman Ned Price says documentation compiled by the conflict observatory will provide evidence for war crimes trials.
The International Labour Organization says about 160 million children around the world are involved in child labour.
Riders said 89 million of those children are between 5 to 11 years old, and that child labour is rising in that age group.
And the U.S. Congress holds its first hearing in half a century on unidentified flying objects. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. The U.S. government is launching what it calls a, quote, conflict observatory, unquote, to document war crimes and other atrocities in Ukraine perpetrated by Russian forces. Details from VOA's chief national correspondent Steve Herman in Washington.
State Department spokesman Ned Price says documentation compiled by the conflict observatory will provide evidence for war crimes trials.
It will shine a light on atrocities and is intended to contribute to eventual prosecutions in Ukraine's domestic courts, courts in third-party countries, U.S. courts, and other relevant tribunals.
The State Department is collaborating with outside entities for the project, including a geographic information systems company, Yale University's Humanitarian Research Lab, and the Smithsonian Cultural Rescue Initiative. The U.S. government is also contributing commercial satellite imagery. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
The European Union's top diplomat Josep Borrell said on Tuesday that the bloc will not leave Ukraine without military equipment as the war against Russia continues. He added that if numbers and reports are true, the Russian army would have suffered, quote, impressive losses, unquote, while invading Ukraine.
I think that this support is making a difference in the battlefield. In the battlefield capacity of the Ukrainian army, we need to sustain the effort. We have to replenish resources and stockpiles, and have to say that this support at that moment is critical because the war is in a critical moment, in a turning point, and we cannot let Ukraine to run out of equipment. I wouldn't dare to make an hypothesis about how long Russia can resist. We are talking about Russia resist. The word resist, we use it with respect to Russia. But if it is true that Russia has lost about 15% of their troops at the beginning of the war, this is a world record on the losses of an army invading a country.
That's the European Union's top diplomat, Josep Borrell. Ukraine's military worked Tuesday to evacuate its remaining fighters from the Vostok steel plant in Mariupol, where 3 months of Russian bombing has left the besieged city, port city, in ruins. Ukrainian officials say more than 260 fighters were evacuated Monday. Flashpoint Ukraine Steve Miller speaks with Anna Chernikova in Kyiv.
On May 16, we received confirmation that evacuation of the soldiers from Azovstal began. Before that, the leader of the Azov battalion announced that they fulfilled the main task that they had, and now their main goal is to save life of the Ukrainian soldiers. So what we know? We know that 53 heavy wounded soldiers were evacuated to Novoazovsk. It's occupied territory in Donetsk region. There, they're going to get all the medical support needed, at least this is the agreement. Another 211 Ukrainian soldiers were evacuated to Olenivka. It's another city in Donetsk region, which is also occupied. All soldiers are waiting for the procedure of exchange, so they should be exchanged with Russian soldiers. So this is for the moment. Also, just a couple of minutes ago, we got also information that another 7 buses have left Azovstal with Ukrainian soldiers, reportedly. For the moment, we don't know exactly the amount of soldiers in the buses, and we don't know the direction where they're going. But as I already mentioned, the evacuation is ongoing. So officials, Ukrainian officials, confirmed that this would be done in the next couple of days.
Anna, does this mean that all the Ukrainian fighters in the Azovstal complex have been evacuated?
Not yet. What we know is that for the moment, reportedly around a couple of hundreds of Ukrainian soldiers remain in Azovstal. But according to Ukrainian officials, they all are going to be evacuated.
That's Flashpoint Ukraine's Steve Miller speaking with reporter Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. Since the start of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, Belarus has been a launching pad for Russian forces. Now thousands of Belarusians who in 2020 stood up to the forces of their longtime ruler, Alexander Lukashenko, have decided to fight for Ukraine, forming Belarusian units and battalions on Polish territory. VOA's Miroslava Gonzadze has an exclusive look inside the training ground for Belarusian regiment known as Pahonia in Poland.
Critics say Belarus has become an accomplice in Putin's war on Ukraine, but many Belarusians who held peaceful protest in 2020 against their longtime ruler, Alexander Lukashenko, have decided to take up arms for Ukraine. Many see an opportunity to free their country from dictatorship. At this training ground in Poland, volunteers are taking their first battle lessons. A former Polish police officer, now a business owner, and his war veteran partner are training Belarusians who signed up for a new regiment known as Pahonia. After a week of training in Poland, the volunteers are transferred to base in Ukraine for a more vigorous months-long exercise. The regiment's leader expects 40 people to sign up each month and for the numbers to steadily grow. The volunteers are resolute in their decision to gain combat experience. Andrei says his family is in Belarus and asked that his face not to be shown for security reasons.
It's not only the war of Ukraine. This is a war of all, of the whole free world and Belarus as well, because Belarus is almost 30 years under dictatorship. And it's very painful for us, for the Russian people, who really want to be free. And our desire, our dream, after a defeat of Putin, we hope that the regime of Lukashenko will be destroyed as well.
For Kirill, who left Belarus long ago, this fight is about freedom as well. He started helping Ukrainians buy military equipment and then realized he had a big battle at home to support.
I realized that we have some Belarusian volunteers, military volunteers, and they are not very good equipped. So we decided to start helping them. We start to send them equipment.
Kirill hopes to show that many Belarusian people, unlike Lukashenko, do not support Putin's aggression.
That's our guilty before the Ukrainian people, because for now we are who hold the Belarusian passport. We are the enemies for them, because our country, which is also occupied by the tyrant Lukashenko, and bomb or shelling from Belarus territory to Ukrainian cities and villages. And only that way we should provide as much help as we can to Ukraine and their people in their fighting with the Russian aggression.
Kirill, like many, was inspired by protest in Belarus 2 years ago. Back then, their protest was peaceful, and protesters were not prepared for the brutality of Lukashenko's forces. Now, Lukashenko's opponents are working to get ready for battle. Miroslava Gongadze, UA News, Warsaw.
The International Labour Organization says the latest figures show there are 160 million children around the world involved in child labour. The figures were unveiled at the ILO's fifth global conference on the elimination of child labour, now underway in Durban, South Africa. Vicky Stark reports.
In his opening remarks to delegates, the head of the International Labour Organization, or ILO, Guy Ryder, said of the 160 million child labourers, half of them are in work that puts their health, safety and moral development at risk. Ryder said 89 million of those children are between 5 to 11 years old, and that child labour is rising in that age group. He called for action to put the fight against child labour front and centre.
We know what works in a big sense. We know social protection, we know education, but the people who know the specifics of circumstances are the people at the national level. There has to be national community ownership of this. So it's not somebody who's going to fly in from Geneva and tell colleagues from other countries the specifics of their own country.
The fifth global conference on child labor is the first to be held in Africa. The ILO estimates most child labor on the continent, about 70%, is in agriculture, where children are often working alongside their families. The European Commission announced that it will invest 10 million euros to mainly target agriculture value chains where child labor is prevalent and exports to the EU significant. The president of the South African Congress of Trade Unions, Ngiswa Lozi, said at a national level there must be political will to end child labor.
Importantly, at the level of government is to ensure that labor inspectors are playing their role, to ensure that we don't just hear about it, but we go and see and ensure that there are also penalties.
Lossie challenged workers to be whistleblowers.
Our responsibility is also to ensure that we monitor our employers, because we want to be workers that are employed by businesses of high ethics, businesses that are going to ensure that they are not only to be driving profit.
Anusha Kavar is chair of Alliance 8.7, an organization working to meet Target 8.7 of the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals to eliminate child labor by 2025 and forced labor, human trafficking, and modern slavery by 2030. Kavar is in Durban to urge more countries to adopt strategic action plans and monitoring. Currently, there are only 26 Pathfinder countries signed up for this.
We are co-producing global estimates about child labor and forced labor. And this is a very important issue for each of the governments and countries that take a step into implementation, because you must know where you start the work and where you end it.
The fifth global conference on the elimination of child labor is taking place at the Nkosi Albert Luthuli International Conference Center in Durban and ends Friday. Vicky Stark for VOA News, Cape Town, South Africa.
In other news, Congress held its first hearing in half a century Tuesday on unidentified flying objects with no government confirmation of extraterrestrial life. Pentagon officials did not disclose additional information from their ongoing investigations of hundreds of unexplained sightings in the sky. But they said they have picked a director for a new task force to coordinate data collection efforts on what the government has finally labeled unidentified aerial phenomena, unquote. Lawmakers from both sides say UFOs are a national security concern, and a defense official says the Pentagon was also trying to destigmatize the issue and encourage pilots and other military personnel to report anything unusual they see. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Libya's incoming Prime Minister Fatih Bashagha, appointed by Parliament in February, left the capital Tripoli early Tuesday. This after an aborted attempt to take the reins of power from rival National Unity Prime Minister Abdelhamid Dibaide. Violence erupted between militia supporters and opponents of Bashagha, forcing him to leave the city after several hours. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Militia supporters of Libya's two rival prime ministers fired rockets and automatic weapons at each other early Tuesday, forcing parliament-appointed Prime Minister Fatih Bashagha to withdraw from the capital after a failed attempt to take control of government administration buildings. Rival UN-appointed Prime Minister Abdelhamid Dibaide's supporters appear to have forced Bashagha to retreat, leaving government ministries under Dibaide's outgoing administration. Dibaide warned that he would strike with an iron fist anyone adversely affecting the security of the people. After withdrawing from Tripoli, Bashagha said he hoped to return in the coming hours and would present his case to the people. He says that he received a very good reception during his 3 hours in the capital and was able to give his message to those in various positions and will address the Libyan people on Wednesday. Bashagha's interior minister, Issam Abu Zariba, urged all parties to respect peace in the capital. He says that his ministry wants all Libyans to know that it is working to protect the lives and belongings of the people and that it is acting peacefully and within the limits of the law. He urged security forces to cooperate with his government in order to take control of ministries in the capital. UN Special Envoy to Libya, Stephanie Williams, told rival forces in a tweet to maintain peace on the ground and refrain from damaging people's property. Libyan analyst Ibrahim Belkacem told Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV that he thinks Bashagha has weakened his political position by trying to take control of the capital, but that Dabeiba does not have a very strong political hand either. The Libyan parliament, which appointed Bashagha, suggested last week that he set up his government in the central Libyan port city of Sirte, hometown of former leader Muammar Gaddafi, who was ousted and killed in a 2011 revolution. Aya Burwaila, a Libyan security analyst, tells VOA that she thinks Dabeiba's clinging to power represents a setback to democracy and accountability in Libya, as well as the unity of the Libyan state. She also defends the proposal for Bashagha to set up his government in Sirte so Libya can cease being hostage to the militias in Tripoli. Dabeiba, who was named prime minister by the UN in 2020, was due to step down after elections that were to take place in December 2021. He refused, however, to resign after the elections were postponed. Libyan parliamentary leaders and the country's ruling Council of State held talks in Cairo over the weekend to discuss various political issues, including rescheduling elections and what to do about resuming oil production and sharing of oil revenues. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Lebanon's Iran-backed Hezbollah political parties and its allies have lost their parliamentary majority in general elections. The Interior Ministry says both Hezbollah and its Christian and other allies suffered losses nationwide. Political rivals and independent candidates from the 2019 protest movements gained seats, expressing outrage by ordinary Lebanese over multiple crises, including a devastating financial meltdown. For VOA, Dale Gavlak reports from Amman.
More than a dozen independents and anti-Hezbollah candidates won parliamentary seats, many for the first time, signaling a deep desire by the Lebanese for change in the moribund political structure. The Lebanese Forces, a mainly Christian party and longtime critic of Hezbollah and Iran's influence in Lebanon, secured 19 seats. All 13 Hezbollah candidates who ran were elected, but a number of the militia's political allies lost, including some of the Christian Free Patriotic Movement, leaving the Hezbollah-led coalition with 61 seats in the 128-member legislature. Professor Habib Malik of the Lebanese American University tells VOA that he hoped voter turnout had been stronger in order to see greater breakthrough for the forces of change.
The showing of the forces of change could have been much more effective with a greater turnout. Still, there were some interesting breakthroughs. Some prominent pro-Syrian, pro-Hezbollah names have fallen. Some impressive holes were punched in the monolith, if I can put it that way. Not enough, but it's a start.
Hezbollah ally and former deputy speaker Ali Fersley lost the seat he held for the past 30 years, as did Talal Arslan, a Hezbollah-backed Druze politician defeated by university professor Mark Daou, a member of a newly founded non-sectarian political party, Takadum. Eye surgeon Ilyas Radeh became the first opposition MP elected in South Lebanon, a region dominated by Hezbollah and its Shiite ally, Amal. Analysts say the two main blocs, which oppose each other, Hezbollah and the Saudi-allied Lebanese forces, could see more political paralysis at a time when the country desperately needs unity and progress. Dania Khaliat Khatib with the Issam Faris Institute at the American University of Beirut comments.
I think there will be paralysis. The Lebanese forces very much campaigned on the issue of sovereignty, the Lebanese identity, taking back Lebanon from Hezbollah. Saudi looked at Jaja as the only one who can stand to Hezbollah. How can he deliver on that without going in a clash?
She was referring to Samir Jaja, leader of the Lebanese Forces Party. Khatib says she hopes that the independents and anti-Hezbollah forces will work together to see the start of positive change. Parliamentary elections took place against the backdrop of the 2019 protests against Lebanon's ruling elite and the August 2020 Beirut port explosion that killed more than 200 people. The United Nations and the World Bank blame Lebanon's ruling elite for the country's economic collapse. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
To all our VOA listeners, please note we have moved our programs to a new website, voaafrica.com, from voanews.com. There you will find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com, and thanks for listening. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voaafrica.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu in Washington, wishing you a great day.
An editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
An Istanbul court sentenced Turkish civil rights activist and philanthropist Osman Kavala to life in prison for allegedly attempting to overthrow the government. Kavala was first arrested in 2017 on charges related to the 2013 Gezi Park protests in Istanbul. The demonstrations grew into a nationwide year-long movement against then-Prime Minister Recep Erdogan's increasingly authoritarian rule. A court later acquitted Kavala of the Gezi Park charges and ordered Kavala released. He was immediately rearrested on charges of taking part in a 2016 coup attempt against President Erdogan, which resulted in the death of at least 250 people and the eventual detention of over 110,000 people, including civil servants, teachers, activists, and journalists. In addition to Kavala, the Turkish court sentenced seven other defendants to 18-year prison sentences for aiding the attempted overthrow of the Erdogan government. Among them was 71-year-old architect Mujala Yepici, Istanbul municipality urban planner Tayfun Kahraman, and documentary filmmaker Çiğdem Mater. The United States is deeply troubled and disappointed by the court's decision to convict Osman Kavala, among others. His unjust conviction is inconsistent with respect for human rights, fundamental freedoms, and the rule of law, said State Department spokesperson Ned Price in a statement. We again call on Turkey to release Osman Kavala in keeping with European Court of Human Rights rulings, as well as to free all others arbitrarily incarcerated. The United States remains gravely concerned by the continued judicial harassment of civil society, media, political, and business leaders in Turkey, including through prolonged pretrial detention, overly broad claims of support for terrorism, and criminal insult cases. The people of Turkey deserve to exercise their human rights and fundamental freedoms without fear of retribution, declared spokesperson Price. The right to exercise freedom of expression, peaceful assembly, and association is enshrined in Turkey's constitution and its international law obligations and Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe commitments. We urge the government to cease politically motivated prosecutions and to respect the rights and freedoms of all Turkish citizens.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.